Good to see everybody. Glad you're back for our study of Judges. This is Judges, right? Sunday's Revelation, Wednesday's Judges. Just want to keep that clear so we don't get them crisscrossed at all. Yes, we've got worksheets if you need one. All right, got a couple down here. Hope you don't mind my readers. I've misplaced my others. I think I know where they are, but I'm not going to go after them, so I'll just use these tonight. We've made it up to the fourth judge. Do a little review about the first three. By the way, welcome to everybody who might be watching online. We appreciate you tuning in with us. And if you're young, tuning in just means... Yeah, that's the way we used to say it back in the 1900s. So, the first judge, God blanked. What's the terminology used, at least if you have a New American Standard? The first judge God raised up. I want to make that point. God is raising these men and lady up to do the work that they are doing. They're not just random. They don't just say, you know, I think I'll do something. God is raising them up. So God raised up the first judge. His name was Othniel or Oatmeal. You can call him Oatmeal if you want to. He's not here. He was a nephew to, you remember? Not Joshua, but Caleb. A nephew to Caleb. Through Othniel, the land had rest for how many years? 40 years. 40 years. We're early enough in Judges, it's not that hard to go back and find that passage. Bless you, by the way, Jeannie. And try to aim it over that way, if you will. The second judge was named Ehud. He was from the tribe of Benjamin, and was blank-handed, left-handed. I find that interesting because what does the name Benjamin mean? Son of my right hand is what Benjamin means. He killed Eglon, king of Moab, and rallied Israel to war against them. Through Ehud, Israel had rest for how many years? 80 years, which is a long time when you think about it. Third in line was Shamgar. That sounds like a 1960s rock and roller, doesn't it? Whose weapon of choice was what did he use to strike down a bunch of Philistines? An ox goad. Which is just a stick you use to poke an ox to keep him going. He used it to strike down 600 Philistines. All right, those are the first four. Anybody got any observations or questions or comments about those guys? All right, Judges chapter 4, 1 through 10. Need a reader for the first five verses, and we'll just split it up. 1 through 5 and then 6 through 10. Who'd like to read? We're in chapter 4. All right, Shannon and Bob. Shannon, you've got the first 5, and Bob, you've got 6 through 10.
After Ehud died, the Israelites once again did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So the Lord sold them into the hands of Jabin, the king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagaman. Because he had 900 iron chariots and had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years, they cried to the Lord for help. Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was leading Israel at the time. She held court under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites came to her to have their disputes decided.
Now she sent the son of Barak, the son of Benon, from Kadesh Naphtali, he said, "Behold, the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded, go and march to Mount Tabor, and take with you 10,000 men from the son of Naphtali and from the sons of Zebulun. I will draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his many troops to the river Kishon, and I will give them into your hand. Then Barak said to her, if you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. She said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey which you are about to take. For the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of the woman. Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. Barak led Zebulun and Naphtali together to Kadesh. 10,000 men went up with him. Deborah also went up with him.
Very good. Thank you. Number one, after Ehud died, Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. Now, there are no dates and no years given for that, except we know that after Ehud killed Eglon, remember Ehud was the left-handed dagger jabber, there were how many years of peace and rest? 80 years. That's a long time. So how long it was after Ehud died, we don't know, or how long he lived, we don't know. That information is not provided. But when he died, Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. So he blanked them into the hand of Jabin. He sold them. What does that say to you? What do you sell? You sell things you don't want. You don't sell things you want. And so he sold them into the hand of Jabin, who was king of Canaan. Jabin's captain over his army was Sisera. If you don't know how to spell it, it's the next word. Sisera had blank chariots of iron. Oh, how many chariots? 900 chariots of aluminum. Iron, okay. Which he used to oppress Israel for blank years. 20 years. Deborah was a blank. She was a prophetess. She was also a judge, but the text is telling us she was a prophetess. What is a prophet or a prophetess? What does that entail? The best definition is a prophet or prophetess is a mouthpiece for God. God speaks through them. That's what prophesying is. It is speaking for God. He gives them a word and they speak it. They say it. So Deborah is a prophetess and the blank of a man named Lapidoth. The wife of a man named Lapidoth. She judged in the hill country of Ephraim. Very good. And the sons of Israel came to her for judgment. So God is raising up judges, and he has raised up Deborah. She is a prophetess speaking forth his word. The people recognize that, and so they deliberately travel to see her for judgments. There's no elaboration on that. We don't know what kind of judgments, but when you've got an issue, you need to be decided. Where do you go? But you go to Deborah. This tells us something. This tells us that people were still recognizing a word from the Lord. That's a good thing to see here. Because what we'll read later in the book of Judges is, every man did that which was right where? In his own eyes. And that's never a good thing to hear or to read. But at this point, she was in the hill country of Ephraim, and people were traveling to go to her for judgments. And you remember last week we talked about the fact that people needed to listen to judges. They listened, so there was teaching going on. There was a word coming from them that was influencing people. It wasn't just that they were raised up to be at one point a military leader and conquer their enemies and then they went on. But these folks were people who were influencers, as we would call them today, in the nation of Israel. Yes?
This was a patriarchal society. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The fact that a woman was judge also pointed to the decline of that society, because God did not raise up any man to fulfill that role as he had in the past.
Yes.
So it wasn't to their credit, that Deborah, taking nothing away from her abilities. But
right.
Right.
And that principle plays out in this story. It's as if God said, all right, I want to show you, I want to give you some idea of the spiritual condition of my people right here. None of the men are rising up to lead. I've thought about this through the years, because that's kind of a controversial issue in the denominational world, but I wonder, and I'm just throwing this out there, if God, for one thing, he designed men to lead, but then he tells us to lead, because I've noticed this about women. Women will lead. And I don't mean that in any negative sort of way. If they see something that needs done, they'll take the bull by the horns and they'll do what needs to be done to get it done. And if God didn't tell men to lead, we would just say, all right, well, I'm going fishing. Women will take care of it. They're good at it. And they are. But God says, that's not the way it's supposed to be, guys. I want you to lead. I've designed you to lead. I want you to lead. This woman I made to be your helper. And that's what she's best at. But when men don't step up to the plate, this is the kind of thing that happens. Now, all of that is my conjecture, my opinion. But Mike and I agree on this. This is a spiritual dearth in Israel. And here she is, and this is the way it's playing out, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit as the story develops, or as we develop the story. All right, number three. You got all the blanks filled in number two there? Prophetess, wife, Ephraim, and judgment? Okay, number three. Evidently, by blank's order, God's order, she summoned Barak to march against Mount Tabor. Now, I said against. It's not necessarily against, but to go to Mount Tabor, that's the direction he needed to go to face off with the enemies. So to march against Mount Tabor with 10,000 men. God promised through Deborah to blank Sisera and his army to the river to draw out. What does that say? That to me sounds like a military plan where you're setting a trap. We need to draw them into this trap. And God says, you go down there, I'll draw them out to you. Ooh, that doesn't sound good for the enemy. But that's what's said. To draw out Sisera and his army to the river Kishon and give them into Barak's hand. Barak agreed to go, but only if blank went with him. Deborah went with him. To this, she agreed, but said the blank of the victory, and she didn't use the word victory, but the honor, the word honor is there, the honor of the victory will be given to a woman. Barak gathered 10,000 from the tribes of blank and blank, Zebulun and Naphtali. Give you a minute to spell those out. 10,000 from the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali and went blank to Mount Tabor. Went up to Mount Tabor. I wasn't just trying to make another blank. I want to make a point that sometimes we miss. When you're reading the scriptures and it says they went up or they went down, it's always accurate. This is not so with other ancient documents. But when the Bible gives you a geographic direction or tells you some detail, noting a river or a mountain or a place, it's always right. It's always accurate. And archaeologists in the past have used the Bible to find things that were previously unknown or undiscovered. So just wanted to throw that in there as a point of interest, at least for me. Now, here's the point I want to talk about. Barak says, I'll go. With a stipulation. Deborah, you have to go with me. Now stop and think about that. Do you think she was good with the sword? Spear maybe. A sling? Why was he saying this? Because we're not told. What did he lack? He lacked faith in the God that was speaking through Deborah. She was the prophetess. She said, you gather 10,000 and you go do this. God has said to do that. And instead of saying, You and me, Lord, here we go. Based on what your prophet said, I'm out of here going to attack our enemies. He said, well, I'll only go.
It shows his attitude.
Well, I don't know so much about that, but it does show when she says what she says. Did I say that right? When she says what she says. What did she say about the honor for the victory? She didn't say it's going to go to somebody else. She said it's going to go to a woman. Was that a slam? What have we seen so far? Men leading. God telling the men to lead. You men go to war. When Israel came out of Egypt, how were they numbered? By the men who were what? 20 years old and upward, able to do what? Able to go to war. So old guys, you didn't count. People who were crippled, you can't say that anymore, though, crippled, can you? People who were combatically challenged. Couldn't see, I made up a new word for that. That's what we do these days. We made up a new word so you don't hurt anybody's feelings. Which, I had to think about that when I read about the oppression. So these people knew what oppression was. Today, if you hurt somebody's feelings, you're an oppressor. We've lost touch with what real oppression is. So here's Barak. He's going to do it. And by the way, don't miss out on this fact. When he sends out for troops, does he get troops? He does get troops. It's as if the men of Israel are saying, if we just had a leader, we would volunteer, we would go, we would come, we would fight. And so 10,000 show up to fight. That's what God said to get. He didn't say get 100,000. He said get 10,000, and so there they are from these two tribes. So he's got volunteers to fight, but they need a leader. Well, they've got a leader, but this leader says, I'm not going unless Deborah goes. Something's lacking. And it's interesting to me that this is what we're told, and God doesn't break in and give us five verses on, here's the problem as I see it from my point of view as God, and here's how you need to do different in your life to make this correction. He just tells us this is the way it went down. And so you and I, 3,000 years later, actually about 3,400 years later, we read this, and we have to make the application to our own lives and in our own thinking about how things are supposed to be and the way things are and what needs to change to make it more like God would have it to be. That's a great responsibility that God's given us, but here it is and here we are. And I don't think he would do that unless he thought we were worthy, not worthy, but capable of making the right decisions. All right. Any observations about any of that? Here we go. Judges chapter 4, verses 11 to 24. Once again, need some readers. 11 through 16, who would like to get that? Johnny? That's a reading hand sticking out there. Right, okay, 11 to 16. And then 17 down to 22. Well, 17 through the end of the chapter. Let's just do that. Who wants to do that? Are you looking for the hard words and the bad names? I'll read it. Okay, I'll read it. Go ahead, Johnny, you read the first part, and I'll pick it up at verse 17.
Heber, the Kenite, had separated himself from the Kenites, from the sons of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Zananim, which is... Zananim, which is near Kadesh. Then they told Sisera that Barak, the son of Obinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. Sisera called together all his chariots, 900 iron chariots, and all the people who were with him, from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. Deborah said to Barak, arise, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you. So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. The Lord... Oops, I bumped it. Okay, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not even one was left.
Now Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. For there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my master, turn aside to me. Do not be afraid." And he turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. He said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty." So she opened a bottle of milk and gave him a drink, and she covered him. He said to her, "Stand in the doorway of the tent, and it shall be if anyone comes and inquires of you and says, 'Is there anyone there or here?' that you shall say, 'No.'" But Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and seized a hammer in her hand and went in secretly to him and drove the peg into his temple, and it went through into the ground, for he was sound asleep and exhausted. So he died. Duh. I just love the way it puts it out there. And behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, "Come and I'll show you the man whom you're seeking." And he entered with her, and behold, Sisera was lying dead with the tent peg in his temple. So God subdued on that day Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the sons of Israel. The hand of the sons of Israel pressed heavier and heavier upon Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, the king of Canaan. All right.
He can say that
she died. I think so. That sounds like a mortal wound to me. Who was that comedian that said death continues to be the number one cause of fatalities in America? Something like that. All right, Judges 4, 11 to 24. Number 4. It is noted here that a man named Heber, who was a Kenite of the sons of Hobab. Now, I've got a historical note in this parentheses. Because who is Hobab according to that? That's Moses' father-in-law. What else is Moses' father-in-law called? What other names does he have? Reuel and Jethro. So he's got three names. Might sound kind of odd to us, but you know people that have at least two names, and you may even know somebody that's called by three different monikers. And there's no real reason given for this. We just know, in this case, we've got Hobab as Moses' father-in-law, but we also know him as Reuel. We know him as Jethro. Just wanted to point that out so there's no confusion. Do what?
The father-in-law lived longer than Moses.
Okay, I don't know.
That's what it says.
Right. What's that?
Sons of Hobab,
yeah. Talking about his sons. He had moved his tent near the area of Kadesh. Kadesh. Now, if you try to find Kadesh on the map, there are a couple of different places that are speculated. One is Kadesh Naphtali, and there's another one down south in Galilee. So it's difficult to pinpoint exactly where this is. But at any rate, this is the place where Sisera will flee to. And that's why this is pertinent. Because if you're just reading the text and you're reading about Deborah and Barak and this plan to attack Sisera and his iron chariots, and then now Heber the Kenite, he moved down to this place. It's like, what? What? What are you putting that in there? Well, that's because this is a big deal where he is because of who he's married to. Yes?
Yes, and also I've also seen had also moved further away because he was trying to be neutral. You know, not to be on one side or another.
Right.
He was a neutral party in the war between the king and the Israelites.
Right.
And it's one of the reasons why Sisera freely went into that tent. You know, he didn't sense any danger.
Supposed to be at peace.
Supposed to be.
That's what's pointed out in the text.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, well, later on, I think it's Saul who is going to make an attack, and the Kenites are where he's going to attack. And so he gets word to them, hey, I'm coming to attack. You guys need to get out of Dodge. And it's just another indication that there was a relationship there. Very interesting to me. And then at the end of number 4, I simply put, the reason for this note becomes clear in the following text. And then we get to number 5. Sisera, captain of blank's army. Who was the king? Jabin. Jabin's army. Sisera, captain of Jabin's army, brings his army with the blank. What did he have? It was of tactical value. He had chariots. Brings his army with the chariots to the blank river. What's the name of it? Kishon River. I'd like you to be familiar with this. Later on, when Elisha goes up on Mount Carmel and defeats the 850 prophets of Baal, he goes down to the Kidron Valley, and I believe it's the Kishon River he winds up at, where he kills those 850 prophets of Baal. So it's a prominent river. It's only about 25 miles long, but it drains the valley of Megiddo. That's the river that is the watershed for the Valley of Megiddo. Y'all love geography class, don't you? So here we are. Sisera, captain of Jabin's army, brings his army with the chariots to the Kishon River, but the blank routs him with his army. The Lord routs him with his army, and they are defeated. Abandoning his chariot, Sisera flees on foot to the tent of Heber the Kenite. Now we see why that was noted earlier in the text, where Heber's wife, Jael, greets him and gives the exhausted man milk. What happens when you drink milk? Yeah. And she probably didn't pull it out of the refrigerator either. After he drinks it, he blank blanks, falls asleep. And while he sleeps, Jael drives a tent peg through his temples into the ground. Dainty little thing that she was. Wouldn't you like to see a picture of her? We're going to meet her one day, I'm sure of it. You're the one. You're Jael. I read about you. Going to see a lot of people. I don't know if we're going to want to ask any questions or get some background or what. I also have an idea that we're going to be just so overwhelmed by the presence of God that we're not going to care about any of this stuff. That may be true. I don't know. It's eternity, and we don't even know what eternity is. It's not time. So I want to, on one hand, think, well, it's time. So after we've been there a while, well, that won't matter. There's no while. You don't spend eternity. Sometimes you hear somebody talk about spending eternity with, you don't spend eternity. You spend time, because it starts at one point and then it goes on. And well, but eternity is different. All right. Judges chapter 5, 1 to 31. We're not going to read this, but I want to look at some things that come out of this. This is the song of Deborah and Barak. You may remember when the Israelites came up out of Egypt, there was a song of Moses and Miriam, and that's recorded. And Miriam even, and the ladies, they took tambourines and danced and sang songs, victory songs. So we've got the song of Deborah and Barak. In their song, there appears to be blanks as to how God dealt with King Jabin's army. I would put the word clues. I believe there are clues in this song as to how God dealt with King Jabin's army and his captain, Sisera. Chapter 5, verse 4 says that the earth blanked. It quaked. The earth quaked. And the heavens blank blanked. Dripped water. What's that sound like? Chapter 5, verses 20 to 21 also record that the blank fought from heaven. Stars fought from heaven. I don't think that means people from Hollywood either. Yes?
I've got a note somewhere. I don't remember where I wrote it down from. But one of the ancient beliefs was that the stars were the source of rain.
Okay.
So that may tie into this some way.
Yeah, well, dripping water sure sounds like rain to me. There's all kinds of possibilities, and I want another verse, but I don't get another verse. 5:20 to 21 also records that the stars fought from heaven, and that the blank of Kishon, the torrents, I have in my translation, the torrents of Kishon swept them away. So it may be that Sisera's blank chariots, what kind of chariots were they? Iron chariots, floundered and were overwhelmed by an blank first, the quaking, an earthquake, as well as a great storm that resulted in the Kishon flooding its banks and making it impossible for the very chariots upon which the Canaanites trusted to be of any benefit. Did you get all those blanks? Because that was all speculative stuff, as it says next. While the above is conjecture, it is at least conjecture supported by phenomena. I don't know why that's capitalized. Phenomena to which the blank refers. The text. You read the text. Deborah and Barak were not just blowing smoke when they wrote this, assuming they both wrote it. And I don't even know who wrote it. But somebody wrote it, and the Holy Spirit said, put it in the book. So what we're reading when we read this song, to some degree, are the facts of what went down in this conflict between Barak and his 10,000 and Sisera's army and his 900 iron chariots. The earth apparently quaked. Or maybe that was figurative poetic language. I don't know. Later on, we'll read about the stars in heaven being shaken and falling. All kinds of wonderful imagery from the heavenly realm. But this may well be literal in this case. The heavens, or the earth quaked and the heavens dripped water. I don't know if you've read much about Germany's invasion of Russia during the Second World War. One of their greatest enemies, the Germans that is, was mud. They had to cross miles and miles and miles of trackless wasteland, and when it rained, everything was a mess. It was a quagmire. It was a horrific nightmare for them. Too bad, right? That's what you get for invading another country. That's what you get for trying to wipe out the people of God. That's what you get for oppressing people. There's so many awful things that the Nazis did, but it's just, you see this in the scriptures and you wonder, okay, what did God have to do with some of those things? Because when you look at history and you see some of the decisions that were made, you think, what were people thinking? And I have to wonder, and perhaps you've wondered too, is God having a hand in these dumb decisions that people are making? And is God having a hand in some of the accidental, coincidental things that work out for the benefit of those who are trying to do the right thing. Read some commentary on what the Japanese did wrong at Pearl Harbor and what they could have done that would have hurt us much more than what they actually did. And one of the things that they did in attacking Pearl Harbor was to solidify a nation that had been wallowing and waffling back and forth. And once they hit us, our resolve turned to iron, and we came back with a vengeance. And that's how the war was won. Anyway, you think, oh, you're talking about a different kind of history. God has his hand in all history. When we read in Daniel that God is the one who raises up nations and puts over them the basest of men, you look back through history and you see, man, that's got to be absolutely true, because that's who we see in power so many times. Just look at our present nation today. And I'm not trying to be critical of anybody. The fact is, base people is all we've got. And if you and I were put in positions of power, I'd like to think, oh, I would never lie because of a political situation. I would maintain my scruples, and I would always do the right thing, regardless of the pressure put on me in a public political situation. Well, that's a nice thing to think, and perhaps we would. We do see that some have done that in history. Daniel is one I think about, put in a very difficult situation, and he maintained his character and his faith in God. Joseph is another one. He could have easily, in Potiphar's house, said, God's abandoned me. He's given me over to a foreign nation to be a slave. I don't have any of my family down here. There's nobody down here who believes in the true and living God like I do. At least that's what I'm speculating. He would have had that situation. Here's a woman who wants me, and nobody would know about it, and I could... all kinds of favors he might be able to have through her. And what does he say? How could I do this and sin against God? And you see God active in his life, even after he goes to prison. It says God gave him favor in the sight of the jailer. And even in prison, Joseph rose to prominence because he kept his faith in God. Now here's a lesson for you and me. We're seeing a situation where there was a spiritual dearth in Israel. I think that's what's reflected, and Mike's making the same observation. We haven't talked about this beforehand, but that's our observation, because God wants men to lead. And in this situation, the woman had to lead. She was the one given the prophecies and called a man to her to do it. God didn't say, Deborah, you go lead the army and fight. No, you call Barak. And Barak says, well, I'll go, but only if you go with me. And yet there is a victory. And he puts the word out, we need soldiers to fight against our enemies. And 10,000 guys show up with their swords to go to battle, and they win the battle. And it says they didn't win it. It says God put to flight their enemies. And that's what I need to keep reminding myself of in my own personal life, that whatever I have that comes up in front of me, God will help me put that to flight. All I need to do is stay faithful. And even if my situation's not put to flight and I have some hardship to deal with, all right, it'll be hardship for a while. But in the final analysis, if I keep my faith, there's going to be a reward. What did Joseph eventually say after all that was over and his family was in Egypt? He said, you meant it to me for evil, but God meant it for good. And that's the way God always does. And that's why Paul, the Holy Spirit inspired Paul to write in Romans, God causes most things to work together for good. Oh, it's all things, right. Okay, God causes all things to work together for good to those to those who love him and are called according to his purpose. That's us. And you don't have to be perfect to qualify for that description. And we're reading about people who were not perfect, and yet God did great things through them. So, observations, comments, questions. It's interesting to me that here's a woman who is serving. God has raised her up, and we get two chapters and a song. We get a song. What do you do with a song? You sing it. And that's what the Israelites surely did after they got this. They sang this song of Deborah and Barak. Is there a song for Samson? I mean, Samson was some kind of a guy, wasn't he? Strong, like nobody's business. He was like an ancient biker type. He hung out with prostitutes and had long hair, you know, all that stuff. Shamgar, remember Shamgar's song? That'd make a cool song, Guy with an Ox Goat, but there's nothing about that. Othniel, start your day with Othniel, nothing. Anyway, but that's just some thoughts about what we're looking at here. So next week, Lord willing, we'll come back and we'll talk about the next judge of Israel and what things we can learn there. What? Oh, I'm sorry. While the above is conjecture, it is at least conjecture supported by phenomena to which the text refers. The song also mentions Jael by name and details how she killed Sisera by, and here's what I would put in there, wisdom and stealth. Now, those aren't words from the text. But when you read the text, it's like, yeah, she was a smart girl. She's, oh, hey, come on in here. I'll give you some milk to drink. He's asking for water, and she gives him milk and covers him up with a carpet. Like, hey, lay down here, take a little nap. And we'll fix things right up. Appreciate you guys. Oh, you bet. I'm having fun.